Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is retired Indian Navy Commodore Sujit Samadar, the service's former director of plans, who is now with the Society of Aerospace, Maritime, and Defense Studies in New Delhi. Sir, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to link up with you, Vago. And I think it's a very interesting dialogue and that I'm really looking forward to discussing various issues with you. Yeah.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Let's start with China. It's certainly looming large everywhere. Beijing has precipitated a conflict, repeated conflicts on the disputed border between India and China. In the United States, there's an enormous focus on how the United States and its allies and partners can continue to deter diplomatically, economically, and militarily. And obviously, the new administration is trying to craft a strategy that brings democracies together against a potentially dangerous autocracy, while at the same time trying to engage with it on key issues, whether on the pandemic or on climate. Can you give us an Indian sense of China and how to view China, especially since the conflict between Delhi and Beijing is heating up in ways that strategists predicted it would?
So that's an interesting question. And I think that's been debated in all sorts of mediums in India, whether it's the political establishment, our foreign policy experts, think tanks, everything else. But India and China have a long history. And I'm not saying, 50 years ago or 100 years ago, we have a long association in different terms, in terms of Buddhism going there and the Silk Road gradually passing through. We've had ups and downs in our historical relationships. And when we both began our independent, we were independent in 47. I think the Chinese were sort of autonomous from 49. And we have walked different paths. But in the initial years, if you recall, when the world was being reoriented and realigned after World War II, it was India which was part of the P5, proposed to be part of the P5, which we declined and deferred to China. Then you might also know that in 1964, before the NPT was to come in, India had all the wherewithal to go nuclear, but we didn't. And the Indian nuclear program also dates back to the mid-40s at the very least. So we've had various things. Of course, then we had the 1962 war between us. And during that time, China occupied a fair amount of Indian territory. And after diplomatic negotiations on both sides, we have now agreed that is a line of control. And while the two sides will resolve these boundary disputes over a period of time, but we'll try and maintain the status quo in these positions so that the progress of both our countries and let's say the people of our country are not adversely impacted from all these happenings in remote areas of both countries. So having said that, last year was quite a surprise, and it was not as if we have not had precipitous, and I like the word that you said, that it is China who precipitates all these, let's say, incursions or interferences in this business. But we lost some soldiers, and the Chinese also lost some soldiers. And I think at the end of it, the message went along that you can't push India. And I think that was a very clear message, which was supported by not only by the military, it was also politically supported that we will not be pushed around. And it was a very interesting, my understanding. It actually borrowed the entire dime philosophy, the diplomatic information military and economic clout that the country had in pushing China off our backs. And I think we have by and large succeeded today. They have disengaged to their previous positions. Our patrol points are again back to wherever they should be. But it's a transient thing. And I think a long-term solution would be in the best interest of both parties. Also, the the national sort of effort, which suddenly boycotted Chinese goods, boycotted Chinese companies, FDI in India was stopped, we stopped trading with them. It didn't hurt China too much, but it possibly sent a signal to the rest of the world that you can stand up to China. And if you do stand up to China, they are likely to back off. I think this is one of our biggest lessons that we have learned, that we, if you stand up to China, they are more likely to back off. If you give up a bit, you will just keep falling back. So I think that was a good thing that the government did. It was a very nice coordination between the Ministry of Commerce, between the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Defense, Ministry of External Affairs, of course, in the lead, right. National Security Advisor, and all of them. So that part was there. But as I said, as democracies are concerned, we didn't push a resolution in the UN Security Council or in the UNGA to censure China for what they did. Maybe we could have done that.
One of the things that's interesting about China is that it is also extremely persistent, right? And very adaptive and very learning. Let me take the conversation to the maritime realm where you've focused on this challenge at the Indian Navy. We heard from the International Institute of Strategic Studies when they launched a military balance. We're going to have a program on that. But China is expanding its military capabilities and its maritime capabilities more broadly. Give us a sense on the capabilities China is fielding and its behavior, both on the military as well as on the commercial side, which is actually as worrying in some respects as its military capabilities.
True, and I think that's a very moot point. At some stage in the overall Chinese development program, maritime power became a very key element of their overall success program because they had to have certain access, assured access to resources, to commodities, to minerals, to trade, and all of that. And that required a certain amount of, let's say, maritime clout to be able to do what they wanted to do. And they, I think, went out on a very well-calibrated plan of developing the entire maritime infrastructure in a very interesting way. So, of course, they focused on shipbuilding, but they also focused a lot on the weapons and ancillary systems which go into ships. And that's why some of these numbers will absolutely amaze you that, you know, they have the DF-21D and then they move to the 26, which is 4,000 kilometers road mobile. As you mentioned in your thing, they are actually carrier killers with ballistic missiles. They're also working on hypersonics, which is a very, very closely guarded secret thing and technology. And but defense against all these things is still work in progress. Neither the U.S. Navy, neither us, or any of us have a complete defense against such systems that are being fielded by them. Increasingly, we have also seen directed energy weapons. You know, I want to be very calibrated in what I say. They have also started fielding directed energy weapons, which can have a completely different disruption in the way we wage warfare in the future. As far as the submarines are concerned, I've got some notes here. They have their 039s, which has a Yuan class, large number of them. Then they had the SSNs and they had the SSBNs, a total fleet of 75 submarines. And just to give you a perspective of what it means is that they produced 12 nuclear submarines in 15 years. 12 nuclear submarines in 15 years. That's not a small achievement, which speaks very, very highly of their management skills, of their ability to build these reactors, and the entire supply chain is in place to deliver such a high rate of shipbuilding. When you look at the aircraft carrier, the first aircraft carrier came in from Ukraine, and they managed to get it operationalized, which was much to everybody's surprise that they could actually reconstruct that carrier in 2012. 7 years later on, they had the second carrier. 5 years later on, they'll have the next carrier, the third carrier. And at the rate at which they are going, they started with a 40,000 ton, then moved to a 60, now they moved to a 70 ton. Probably the next one will be 100,000 tons. So what does it mean? Their design and engineering capability is also phenomenal. I mean, if you're doing more of the same, then I can understand that you can make, you know, 4 aircraft carriers, let's say in 10 years or so. But if you're making different aircraft carriers, bigger and bigger with new systems in, they started off with a normal angle deck and a ramp. Now they've moved on to EMALS. So there's a huge technology which is coming in the aircraft carrier business as far as they're concerned. When you look at the cruisers and destroyers, again, it's phenomenal. They produce 8 ships, destroyers of 10,000 tons with all the weaponry and surveillance systems in 6 years. they produced their 05 to 40 destroyers in 30 years. I have here a number which amazes me, is they produced 30 frigates in 11 years. Corvettes, I mean, they're like making electric toasters or something. They produced 42 of them in 6 years. Assault ships are coming up. The 076 assault ship is a very fine design from whatever is there in the media. It's going to be a complex synergization between manned and unmanned platforms, including UCAS, UAVs, helicopters, email systems, hovercrafts. So that's a lot of work that has happened. So if you look at those projections, and I think this is very important for the Quad to understand, what is the Quad strength today? Today, Japan has, let's say, 154 ships. The Royal Australian Navy has got 46. U.S. Navy has got a total fleet of about 300 ships, but deployed in the Indian Ocean, maybe 100 ships. The Indian Navy has about 140 ships. That's put together a total force, or whatever way you want to say it, just ship to ship. I'm not getting into aircrafts, etc. Maybe about 400 ships. By 2030, the Chinese will have 425 ships at a minimum. And the key point that we have to understand is that after... while they built up this capability in naval ship building, they also built up a huge capability in merchant ship building. In 1996, right, the U.S. made only 500,000 tons of shipping. By, around 2000 or thereabouts, they actually started making, they had 39 million tons in 2011. And today they have 44% of the global market share for ships. And what does it mean for trade? VLCCs, crude carriers, container carriers, car carriers, bulkers, all of that is built in China. So they can play around with freight trades, they can play around with various destinations and, you know, cock up places that you can't access to. So if Indian produce wants to export thing, we pay $60 billion a year for carrying Indian cargo to various points, probably on Chinese ships, for all I know. I don't know, maybe they're Korean or Japanese, etc. But this is a huge thing. Tomorrow, you can artificially raise the cost of your exports by increasing freight charges. So, you know, you can play around with the trade business and see whose cars get exported and whose cars don't get exported. The Chinese have begun exporting their cars. So that might be quite a big challenge for Japan and South Korea and in time Europe and the US too, if they start doing the same thing. So, interestingly, the amount of investments and the strategic thinking they have put into the shipyards is phenomenal. They combined the two largest shipyards to create the largest shipbuilding conglomerate in the world, which has 25% of the total, one company, 25% of the global share of merchant shipbuilding. So these are not numbers that we can sort of ignore, and which reflects that the ability of the Chinese industry to ramp up production in let us say, for a contingency that may or may not develop is unmatched. I don't think neither the Quad or anybody else can put together that sort of a ramp up of capability to do it. And they have done a very smart model. They've just looked at pipeline model of production, which is what I've been advocating in India as well. And that's what maybe the Americans have been doing for some time. So they just roll out these ships every year, and every ship is better than the previous one. So you're not waiting for the best ship to come out and then do the rest. The first of class is out in 2.5 years. Imagine you destroy first of class in 2.5 years, and then you're delivering every destroyer every 10 months, which is better than the previous one. So from these sort of considerations, I don't see why China should not, considering that they need to have the access to most of the crude which is coming in from the Middle East. But that might be a transition thing. As we all know, fossil fuels is almost, you know, shelf life of fossil fuels is over. New technologies on hydrogen, batteries, and many other alternative fuel sources are coming up. So that dependency on the Middle East and Angola, etc., for their fuel sources might decrease over a period of time. I don't know how this will play out, but still, trade will still remain. The markets are going to go, their products are going to be traded through the Malacca coast into the Malacca Straits, into the Indian Ocean, and from then on to Europe and to everywhere else in the world, Africa. Plus, they have a lot of interest. They have invested a lot of money into, I think they're 45% of their overall investment is in Middle East, North Africa, and that sort of area. I mean, west of Malacca Straits. 45% of the investors. So if something goes wrong, they need to protect those investments. So I think this is where I see the maritime scene is, and this matter of concern for everybody, that this growth of China does not impact the rest of humankind.
By the way, we're trying to drive home to our audience is the sense of urgency, right?
Yes.
Do you feel that sense of urgency? I mean, how long do you think the window is for us to continue to deter the Chinese, right? At what point do you, I mean, are you concerned that this window is a small window? Especially if they see, for example, if they feel that they can act with impunity against Taiwan, for example.
My sense is, you know, and let me say, it's not my sense, you know, after I read this fantastic report, which came out some time ago on the assassin's mace, you know, this whole business about this little green men, assassin's mace, etc. You know, the way they're going to design the next combat, you know, as we call it, the design of battle, is not going to be the way we think wars will be fought. As you know, we are fighting the last war, and that is my biggest concern, that we all put together are fighting the last war, whereas China is equipping for a future war. And there is a huge delta between the last war and the future war. And, you know, the kind of force structures that you need, the kind of skill sets that you need to wage a future war, which is completely different. I don't think we are anywhere near it. I'll share an idea, discussion with you on how this has played out on a tabletop game in India. This is off the record, but you can just...
Okay.
You know, we played some tabletop games, and in all of these things, even before the war started officially, we are already smacked in 12 hours. Because we have Maoists in India, we have no Nehruists or Gandhiists in China. So they went and attacked the entire infrastructure in India and through their entire business of networks and all of that, and spurred a whole lot of domestic turmoil and violence internally. So whilst they were having a standoff on the border, and the government was suddenly put back, and there were these huge things happening all over India, you know, airport stopped working, railway system stopped working, communication stopped working, then we have all these insurgencies who are blasting off IED devices, everything. And there's a game, a tabletop game between red and blue. And this was a completely new way to fight. And here we had, you know, these battalions up and there's fighter aircrafts here and all of these guys ready to blast the hell out of everybody else. But we suddenly had to look back and say, hey, what's happening behind? Okay, this is blowing off here. That thing's not working. There's no railways. It's, you know, it's a different war. So I think there is plenty of room for very serious thought as to how a future war would be fought. And knowing the Chinese as little or as much as I know, there is one very key principle that they always follow. They never fight a fair war. That's my personal view. They never fight a fair war. Never. I mean, it's a done thing. You have to create asymmetries, and they're masters of creating asymmetries, whether it's of interest, whether it's of force, whether it's of time, whether it's of resources. They will first create an asymmetry and then go in for it. And this is what they did. 2008 Chinese Olympics, the Beijing Olympics. That was a big turning point for them. They kept quiet up to 2008, announced to the world, look, this is what China can do. This is Beijing Olympics. Wow. After that, they just put the gear up in front. So, you know, their whole style of thought comes from the game of Go, which you know, where AlphaGo beat the Go warrior. And that is their game of strategy, which has got some billions of moves. The Indian game of strategy is chess, where, you know, I have 16 pieces on my side, you got 16 pieces on your side, and the game is played as with the complexity reducing as the moves as the pieces are off the table. But in the game of Go, it's a completely a different game. Initially, the game is very simple, but as the game develops, it becomes more and more and more complex. So we have been all been playing chess, and the Chinese have been playing Go. In the game of chess, we have a game which becomes simpler and simpler as the game progresses. In the game of Go, the game becomes more and more complex as the game progresses. And these are two different strategic sort of, both are strategic games. And how do you play this game is gets into your culture. I think where we want to see is, you know, look, let's not get into the combat part of it immediately, because that becomes very, very sensitive. You know, all of us will fire missiles together and all these torpedoes will go and sink all these submarines, etc. Where I would think that we need to work and put our minds together is on the ISR capabilities of being able to predict and share what's happening. You know, and those things can be done through satellites and all of that, which Vivek and his team are doing, using very nice technology systems that are there in North America and in Australia, new technologies on ocean surveillance. So forewarned is forearmed. So if you're forewarned, I'll be forearmed. I know where this whole thing is heading. So I'm not rushing around to, you know, send out this whole fleet from Hawaii to the Indian Ocean region. It'll take them 50 days to barely get here, by which time the game is over. And that entire transit, you are under perpetual threat. So, yep. So some basing options need to be figured out. Your nearest port of call is Singapore and the Malacca Straits, where you can actually do any repairs and refits. So one of the things, though we have a logistics service agreement between us in place, but I think an investment into Indian shipyards who can handle US destroyers, aircraft carriers, and whatever else for routine repairs and refits. I'm not talking about detailed repairs and refits, you know, just come in there and, you know, change a propeller or paint the damned hull or some such thing, and you get some rest and recreation, that sort of thing. And there are potential opportunities where it can be done in India. So one of the things is what the Chinese have gone and done is that they have now got Djibouti, they've got Mozambique, they've got Kenya, they've got Ambantota. I'm not sure whether they'd be able to use it or not, but certainly some places in other parts, in of course, Gwadar. So even if they bring their fleet here, they know that they can go to these ports and repair and refit. Where does the US Navy go and repair and refit? Suppose this whole deadly combat happens and we are going to take hits, both of us, them and us. So where will you go and send your ships to repair? You can't go through Malacca Straits at that time, because if your damaged ship is going past Malacca Straits, whatever is left of it will also go away. It's such a constricted passage. So how do you work this out?
Well, so I would say, okay.
Infrastructure for all this, ISR systems for all this, let's try and get that part right.
We can have a
detailed discussion on those issues, you know, so that they don't become, they're not violent. They're okay. We are in this region, so we want to repair and refair our ships. So we'll repair it here, we'll repair it there, and we'll bring this, bring that. So it's a nice thing. Okay, good. So, word. So, and he can't, he's also got some very 20 bases here where he goes and repairs and refits, and his submarines go and spend wherever, whatever they want to do.
The repair part of it is a huge problem. And then U.S. Navy has not wanted to address it, and the last administration made it worse. So, for example, the last administration pulled ship repair work from Japan and sent it to the west coast of the United States.
In all battle, there will be casualties. And this is a recognition that comes up from both sides. You know, I'm not fighting with you on what's happening right now. I'm looking behind you. I say, okay, I don't need to sink you. You know, if I just damage you bad enough, you'll sink on your own. So my exactly. ammunition expenditure is planned on that way. Okay, I just need to pump in two of these missiles. The fellow will be drifting, and after a few days, he'll go. I don't need to put 20 missiles into you to sink you. It's good for me. And I just put two missiles to keep you incapacitated, and neither can you go back to your home port, neither can you go anywhere else. What a big deal. So, you know, so infrastructure to be able to operate in an adversarial environment requires a fair amount of repair, refit, so you got 36 missiles, you've now pooped off all your 36 missiles. For the 37th missile, you go back to Newport to pick it up or what? So you know, how do we get this right? And I think this is where all four of us have to sit together, and so that we build this giant plan of, you know, how each ship can be repaired in different parts, how logistics can be brought in. You know, I can ship, I can fly in the missiles, but, you know, from wherever it's built, God knows, ABCD, and it comes to some place. And how do you get there?
You know, when you and I last spoke, you gave me some fascinating statistics on, you know, as formidable as the Chinese military investment is, it's also mind-boggling in terms of the fishing fleet. And so give us some of the statistics, which are sort of mind-blowing. As China becomes more middle class, it has greater demand for protein, more fish, more pork, what have you. What are the implications for the world's oceans at a time when folks are very, very concerned about the potential for collapsing fish stocks and what the new generation of Chinese fishing ships will mean for those stocks, and also a source of friction and conflict around the world.
Very true. But, you know, before we move to the fishing side, I just want to highlight a few things. You know, Chinese population is about 1 billion. So even if every Chinese eats just 2 eggs a day, that's 3 billion eggs. That turns out that you need to feed the chickens 180 million metric tons of feed every year so that the Chinese can have 2 eggs a day, which I think is a reasonable aspiration for humankind. But if you also bung in what you like to eat for a chicken at just 200 grams, of chicken a day, that's adds another 10 million tons of food. And that's about 190 million metric tons of food that will feed the chickens, that will feed the Chinese. Similarly, when you look at pork, at just, you know, a very nominal 300 grams per day, and that's their favorite food, it would consume 280 million bushels of corn. So you know, what I'm saying is the Chinese progress has to be also balanced in a sustainable way. Similarly, on the lines of their other sources of protein, which is from the oceans. As you know, today, a large majority of the IW fishing fleet originates from those shores, and they are no longer restricted to in the neighboring areas of their own country, in the South China Sea, East China Sea, the Yellow Sea, or all little forays into the Pacific Ocean. They are now, you know, if you track this, you'll be surprised to find they're off South America, they're off the Antarctic, they're off in all sorts of places. And just to give you a perspective, there is a proposal to put 100,000 ton fishing sort of factory at sea. That's like huge. So, you know, this completely does not gel with the SDGs. The SDG 14 is about oceans and sustainable fishing. If we do not curtail this as an international movement, we'll be left with no fish in a few years from now. And please couple this also with the Chinese exploration of deep sea fishing, deep sea mining that is happening, which will bring in a huge amount of penalties on the ocean. And the oceans are our final bastion against climate change. If we let that go to ruin, we've had it. In 10 years, 15 years, it will be a completely different world. And it's not possible to get them back. What we lose the species, we lose the species. You can't get it back. So I think these are matters of extreme concern for everybody, and some global action needs to be taken so that, if we can go to sustainable food, that would be the best thing to do. And moderation is the message, and that I think in India, we always had a very deep sense of moderation, what we eat, what we do. So I think moderation is the word, and I think global action needs to be taken to maintain our oceans are healthy. That some fish remains for everybody to eat, but you can't just leave it to just one country grabbing all the fish and everybody else just gets the salt.
Let me ask you briefly on the work of the think tank, and also you guys are going to have a very action-packed conference in April that we both agree would be very interesting for a Washington audience. Give us a very quick sense on the think tank and what the audience should expect in the April conference and where they can register.
Thank you. The Society for Aerospace, Maritime and Defense Studies is a fairly early society. I mean, we just spent about 9 months, but we already have a very illustrious list of mentors, distinguished members who are all former chiefs of the services, ambassadors to different countries, secretaries to Government of India, former secretaries to Government of India, industry leaders, and all of that. So this is one of the few platforms, I think maybe the only platform in India, which does not look at just aerospace, maritime, and defense as a security issue, but we look at it as an industrial ecosystem. So, and to develop the industrial ecosystem in India. So what we did a couple of days, months ago, we did something on contracting and how to share the experience that our mentors have with industry on negotiating defense contracts, promotion of defense exports, how can mm-hmm. we do leasing. And this is something important for the US to watch on how much more we can do in terms of leasing of equipment, whether they are government-to-government leases or private companies leasing various sorts of equipment to India. So the next two series are going to be on artificial intelligence, and that is going to be in artificial intelligence in warfare. We have some very good people coming in from the US to speak on this, from the Mitchell Institute. We have already invited some people. And these are over 4 or 5 sessions. And we expect the Indian Air Chief to be there for the Air Warrior Symposium. That is called AI and the Air Warrior. That's in last week of March or so, and which will have a fair amount of representation from the US and from different parts of the world in discussing multi-domain warfare, looking at issues on AI and unmanned systems, models, algorithms, stuff like that. It's very, very interesting. And I certainly will share all the links with you, and you can open that up. But the more fascinating thing from a Quad perspective is what we want to do on the blue economy, where somehow the maritime security aspects of the blue economy has been missed out a bit. So we have a session where we have invited 6 former chiefs from different navies to join us to discuss on collaboration for secure, safe, and sustainable oceans. From the US, we have Admiral Scott Harbison Swift, who has agreed to join this panel, which will be chaired by our former chief. Then we have a lot of technologies on ISR and artificial intelligence, on which we have some very erudite speakers from across the world, from the US, UK, Spain, Kenya, and an industry expert coming in from Portugal probably at this moment. A key area of, and this is again very important for both our countries, is this whole business of marine spatial planning. We are both late in this game. The US is still trying to do that, and we are starting to think about it. So you are at least a little way ahead. But the European Union has done a smart work of marine spatial planning. So we have put together a very interesting panel, and I certainly hope through this medium that the NOAA also joins this discussion, because they have done some good work on this, and we really look forward to participation from them. So this is in a very nutshell what we want to do. And at the end of it, both these papers will produce some thought leadership. Both these seminars will produce some thought leadership papers on maritime security and the blue economy, the role of artificial intelligence in future warfare. And one of the ones that we want to do together, maybe in September-ish or so, is on digital diplomacy. So that is something we are now learning, the power of artificial intelligence in shaping diplomatic negotiations. So these are very ambitious agendas, and with friends, support from friends like you, I'm sure we'll be able to crack this, and it will be mutually beneficial for both our two countries.
Sir, thanks very, very much. An absolute pleasure. Look forward to having you back on again, especially as we get closer to the conference, so that you can give our audience another update. And obviously, they can go to your website for more information. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. And good luck to all of my friends there. Bye-bye. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.